Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Which brings us to the question and answers slot, and any questions that you might have for Gareth or for Andy or for both. If you have a question, if you would please raise your hand and wait, though, for the microphone to arrive before speaking, and then stand up and give your name and organisation before asking your question. And if I can ask online viewers to use the submit question to chair button, that's, I think, where the high-tech solution ends, because actually someone will wave at me from the back to tell me that a message has been received. So we've a little over 10 minutes to take questions. Please.
Hi there, David Matthews from Times Higher Education. Andy, you mentioned that the drop in HE in FE numbers about the same as the rest of the sector. I don't know what else you've heard about how that breaks down. Are some colleges suffering really big drops while others not so much? And also, have all the margin places been filled? And I'd ask that question to both of you, because I'm sure you both have lots of contact on the ground on that, and maybe you as well, James, if you have any insight into that.
Gentlemen, Andy.
I think it says questions and discussion, not answers. I'm not sure I can give loads of answers. I think the headline figures of a 10 or 11% drop, and actually, I mean, it's 14% across the sector, the HE sector as a whole. It does hide a kind of multitude of different institutional experiences, not just HE and FE. I mean, you know, lots of publicity about Southampton, Cardiff, Liverpool in the Russell Group losing big numbers this time round. I mean, my sense is that is also true in FE. So it may be, you know, lots of principals like vice chancellors are very bullish about where their kind of, you know, numbers are. But some of the specialists within FE with long-standing relationships seem to be doing slightly better. So, yeah, I don't know whether Hartbury is an example of that, but kind of the land-based sector might be doing kind of reasonably well out of that. But as things stand, you know, that's up to each individual institution to kind of come clean on. So I can't offer that. I mean, the one other thing I would just say to sort of qualify it in terms of HE and FE is that, and this is something kind of John Widdowson might talk about in the Durham context, is that because of the local nature of that recruitment, you know, January is a much more significant recruitment point for FE than it is for HE. So however far down kind of individual institutions might be, there is more of an opportunity to make that up in year within HE and FE than there might be for the rest of the sector. So, you know, not much of an answer, but a bit more information.
I think, David, that I concur with a lot of that, and I think there was a lot of tight lips around, again, in case word got out that recruitment was under and that might spread in some way in changing perceptions of the capability or image or brand of that particular institution. That I spoke to two or three vice chancellors at this CVU conference at the beginning of last month. Their biggest worry was that indications were that the no-shows may be higher than in previous years, in that at the vet there had been some very last-minute decisions not to go to take up the place that had been offered, and so I think until the very very last day that the doors shut, I think institutions are keeping tight lipped about this particular issue. Gareth, did you have a particular?
Only to remind us that when we hear both national agencies and newspapers reporting numbers, we need to distinguish between full-time and part-time students. Part-time students are the majority. So the UCAS early numbers will indicate full-time students, and not all college full-time students are necessarily going through UCAS either, perhaps. But importantly, we need to wait probably until HEFG's early return data to get a much fuller and reliable picture of how the landscape is changing or not. The key question, I think, is the one posed for HEFG now. Do they abandon this show? Or rather, do ministers say, do we give up on this? With 5,000 numbers in play. If there is a unevenness in recruitment among colleges and universities, are we going to institute punishment for that? Or do we just pull out of the core and margin as it's currently constituted? I think that's the really interesting question coming up, and it's very, very close.
Another question, please. Yes.
Hi, good morning. John Real from Newcastle College. I just wondered whether or not, Gareth, you think that's a fair position to be in, whether or not decisions should be made at this point of a new regime where there's so many factors affecting student recruitment that it might be argued that it would be safer to leave it for another year until things settle down, because clearly there are other agencies causing some difficulties over student recruitment by a lack of response on their part, for example, the student loan company.
I think your question presupposes a rational policy-making process.
Probably there are people who could bring some rationale and some reasonableness into the government thinking.
But seriously, there is a experimental nature to the core and margin exercise, and it's unravelling with unintended consequences, and I think that's likely to drive ministerial and coalition thinking about whether to maintain, evolve, or perhaps consider an alternative post-2015 model. So there may well be seeing out the current phase with a view to revisiting a very different way of managing student numbers under conditions of constraint.
Andy?
For my sins, I've had to spend a couple of days this week at the Conservative Party conference, which where I wasn't quite stalking David Willetts, but I was in quite a lot of the rooms that he was in. And it's clear that, you know, the thing that underpins his sort of ambition for policy and these mechanisms is that he wants to get rid of number controls completely. He thinks that this is the, with some degree of justification, I think, that, that A, obviously doesn't allow kind of proper choice, proper competition, and it's far too big a kind of responsibility stroke exercise of power from the centre that he's sort of ideologically and kind of practically uncomfortable with. But, probably core and margin, you can put that in either side of that place. But I get the sense from what he says that, the big direction of travel is that, which is take the number controls away, let everyone compete. Along the way, I think he knows that he's kind of hamstrung by, you know, what the Treasury will allow him to do in a year-by-year way. I think he's committed. He said this week he's committed to the 5,000. He's committed to ABB. So that's not going to change. But in terms of the drops in students, I mean, the drops in enrollment, I mean, he is right, just as Gareth is right, to point out that, if you unpack that 58,000, there's a lot of deferrals that might, that didn't defer last year and have deferred this year. That takes about 25,000 of them. And there are lots of little kind of clumps of things that might explain it. But Gareth's right to talk about part-time. My worry, no one I've spoken to yet has said the kind of part-time market is doing particularly well. I understand why it isn't. I mean, the recession, if you like, has a sort of twin effect on enrolments for young kind of, the rising cohort where there isn't much youth employment out there. There isn't a lot of choice, whether you like the kind of the reforms or the choice on offer within kind of the system. There isn't a lot of choice outside of it. If you're part-time and you're in work, even if it's a job you don't like or you don't want to stay in, you're giving up something quite significant in the teeth of a kind of, you know, long recession and a poor labour market. So unless that part-time option works with it, you know, you aren't necessarily going to kind of bite people's hand off at this time. So I think you know, there is a reason why the part-time market is not as healthy as it might be. I think that'll change over time, but the recession is kind of holding it back. So I don't think that's going to be the salvation for lots of institutions.
Okay. Thank you, Andy. There's one more question, time for one more question, which I'll take from the online viewers, if I may. Yes, did you get that question, Gareth?
Yes.
Yes.
I think the question was, in the case that didn't come over, whether asking Gareth to expand on the notion of narrow progression. And the second question, Holly?
The second question comes from Alan Tree at the University of Sunderland. Drop in HE in FE numbers seems to be particularly affecting PT students. Will this tick rating for Gareth's claim? Participation slide.
Can I have a go at the first question? I'm not sure I can get to the second one. We have witnessed English higher education becoming more stratified as a result of intended government policies. So research policy is deliberately encouraging concentration of research funds in particular sets of institutions. Teaching funding has been on a broader, comprehensive basis. Funding, on average, at the same unit of resource, independent of where the teaching is undertaken. But of course, with differential fees, that is not just disturbed, that is undermined. So we're seeing drivers, both on the research side and on the teaching side, which are arguably opening up hierarchies and degrees of differentiation, which perhaps are wider than before. Now, if that's the case, issues of how students enter higher education and the status and integrity and resource base of their learning is important, as is their potential to be mobile, such that enhancing your capital achieved by a first higher education qualification may well be dependent on how you translate that. And of course, in the absence of a credit system, we don't really have an easy way to do it, even if there was a lot of open mobility encouraged. My concern is that colleges have argued for, or rather have accepted, a definition of higher education, which is high specificity, occupational specific, and in some cases, short life higher education. Right? As long as employer demand for specific sets of skills are there, then a program has a life. When that goes away, it doesn't have a life. And the foundation degree, arguably, was designed to be that kind of qualification, able to be highly responsive, matching curricula to employment and labour market needs. Yep. But given the volatility and turbulence which we have been highlighting, the issue for students may well be the ability to navigate in a lifelong way and trade with qualifications which may not have as much exchange value because of their high specificity than other kinds of qualifications. So I guess I'm arguing more radically for broader notions of higher education, which can be developed in college settings. And we should be challenging, I know we have to challenge an awful lot, but intellectually and educationally, perhaps we should be challenging the forms of higher education which are assumed to be highly suited to college settings.
Mm. Okay, thank you, Gareth. And three ticks still for WP, yes or no?
Yes.
Yes, that is the answer to the second question. Right,
thank you very much.
Three-second delay.
Refreshments are going to be served in room 118. Please, if you could be back in this room so that we can start as promptly as possible at 11:40. But please, would you join me in thanking our contributors so far, Professor Gareth Parry and Andy Westwood.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.